It is Thursday. Good morning. Welcome to Perspectives on WFSU-FM. I'm Tom Flanagan. Thanks so much for being at the other end of the radio waves and the telephone lines and the email machine and the Twitter account and all those other multitudinous ways we have of communicating with each other nowadays. And before we get underway, a reminder, you are always welcome to be part of the discussion by giving us a call locally, 414-1234. Long distance is 800-926-8809. Email perspectives at WFSU.org. And if you want to send us a tweet, that's at WFSU Perspective. So much in the news now has been gun violence. We're just coming off of an absolutely horrific weekend in the city of Chicago. 82 gun violence incidents in just a matter of a few days. 16 was the last figure I heard for the number of deaths resulting from those shootings. Really horrific situation. And here in Florida's usually much more sedate and laid-back capital city, we have been seeing some increase in gun violence to the tune of sometimes one incident a week in recent months. So we wanted to get a better handle on what might be behind it and what, more importantly, what kinds of responses the community as a whole is starting to muster in dealing with this kind of situation. So we have an absolutely phenomenal panel here lined up with us today. We've got doctoral candidate Ed Clark from the Institute of Public Health at Florida A&M University. And almost Dr. Ed, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
We have a gentleman that many folks are aware of from coming on board back on December 30th, 2013, Tallahassee Police Chief Michael DeLeo, before that Deputy Chief of the Plantation, Florida Police Department for low, what, Chief, 25 years, I think?
No, I was about 20 years down there.
About 20 years down there. So, and all settled into to Tallahassee and
we're Justin. It's going well.
Rocking and rolling. Pastor Rudy Ferguson also joins us. He's with the New Birth Tabernacle of Praise out on Harlem Street. Pastor Ferguson, good to see you, sir.
Thank you for having me.
And no stranger to these microphones, the former president and CEO of Boys and Girls Club of the Big Bend, and before that, statewide executive director of the Guardian Ad Litem program, Teresa Fleury. Hey, Teresa.
Hey. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, folks, for coming in. Pastor Ferguson, you had a little get-together not too terribly long ago. In fact, a couple of them here. Talk about that. What precipitated your bringing in many people, including some folks here at this table, into one place and saying, hey, let's talk about this?
Well, the gun violence in Tallahassee is no new challenge, and we've heard it before some years back, and then it just seemed to be a very major increase, in particular when it came down to law enforcement, and particularly African-American males. And what we were hearing in the community, especially where my church is, what I was hearing that the police officers are targeting African-American males. And certainly we wanted to reach out to the chief on the first incident. He was very receptive, and he spoke about it. And then another incident happened, and then another incident happened. And certainly we wanted to bring the people around the table that could address the issue. We didn't want young people on Facebook to have this mindset that they're being targeted by the police department. Certainly we want to have them to come. Let's talk about it. Let's see where this is stemming from. And so on June 19th, along with the chief, Commissioner Andrew Gillum, City Manager Anita Favors-Thompson, and Commissioner Bill Proctor, and a few others that were in the building, we sat around a table at the church, a very small church. But nevertheless, people came in and they addressed their questions, their concerns to the chief, to the city commission in regards to law enforcement, in particular the black community. And certainly what happened was we walked away with a clear understanding of what needs to begin, what immediate positive impacts need to take place. So that was just at the beginning. Then we had another one on the 26th of June, a follow-up meeting without the media. And certainly we had a few other people to come in and address their concerns. And we had another one on Tuesday. We had another one, and people came in, pastors from all over and community leaders. So the goal is to find out what is causing our young people to pick up guns and, more importantly, to find themselves combating with law enforcement. So this was something that we wanted to have a conversation about.
Chief DeLeo, you've been part of this conversation from the get-go. Well, first, you know, coming from Plantation, Florida, you know, to a nice, laid-back college town, quiet, reserved, what could possibly go wrong? Was that a surprise to you that we had that level of crime, particularly coming off of what had been a decrease in crime statewide? FDLE stats that come out showing that, well, gee, violent crime throughout Florida is really on the downswing. And here you get to Tallahassee, and suddenly we seem to have these incidents popping up all the time.
Well, actually, I was very aware of it before I got here. That was part of the research I did as far as when I applied for the job and interviewed for the job. And I had discussed those topics when I came in for the interviews, was the violent crime rate in Tallahassee. And I think sometimes people get very comfortable saying, well, crime is down, but the fact is it doesn't mean it's not an issue. In other words, the fact that it can be down, but the fact is it's still unacceptably high. And when your crime rate is significantly higher than the state average, to say it went down a few percentage points, everyone kind of says, oh, well, crime's going down, we're good, as opposed to saying, well, crime is still occurring. People are still getting hurt. We don't have enough opportunities for success for people. What are we doing about it? And sometimes we get comfortable with the crime is down as opposed to, as a community, what can we be doing to really dramatically reduce crime? And, you know, obviously in an ideal world, there would be none, but to get it to where it's acceptable level as opposed to almost 50% higher than the state average.
Yeah, and the secret is not necessarily just to put more units on the street.
No, it has to be a community approach, and that's what we've been trying to work on. And I've been reaching, you know, unfortunately, by the time the police are involved, most times the crime's already occurred. We're the back end response. It's too late in some cases. The idea is, what can we all do together to work and find preventative programs, education programs, diversion programs, and help, you know, stop the pipeline for criminal activity, to help people have opportunities to take advantage of so many programs that are here in place already, to get the programs to collaborate and work together and the different non-for-profits, and instead of competing with each other, mm-hmm. and making people aware of the opportunities are, because there are a lot of opportunities here and there's a lot of good programs in place.
Okay. Well, Ed Clark, let's talk about the research that you do in your area there, where you're actually digging into some of the motivations, the backstory on what causes this level of crime, of gun-related crime particularly. What is your research in?
Well, basically, what I found early on in my research, to the chief's point, is that Leon County is on par with Miami-Dade County as it relates to the number of gun-involved crimes. We both are about at 162 per 100,000 population. So I began to look at what was the underlying causes for the increase in certain communities and within certain demographics as it related to gun violence. And as the chief indicates, there are a lot of issues that stem out of poverty mostly, and lack of opportunity for young people to get involved in the mainstream economy. That lends itself to people taking part in what we would call a black market economy. That has in turn created a code of the streets, so to speak, where young people are more concerned about their street cred than anything else, and they're willing to go to almost any length to protect that. Mm-hmm. So we see ourselves dealing with situations in some of our populations where young people are feeling the need to defend themselves, feeling the need to defend turf, feeling the need to establish themselves as someone in the community, and they're resorting to guns to do that.
Someone who's been dealing with that, well, the 3 years, Teresa Fleury, that you were heading up the Boys and Girls Club of the Big Bend, how much of that did you see? I mean, in the kids that you dealt with and that your program served?
You know, the kids that we dealt with, at least they were part of something positive. There's so many kids out there that are not. And, you know, I fully support what the chief said, is that it takes a community. And, you know, thankfully, Pastor Rudy, you know, brought together the community. But as he stated, when the media was there, you had a ton of people there. And that's how we felt, is that, you know, if it was a media event, then we had people there to support. But what those kids need is people there to support them at all levels every day, not just when the media is there. You know, it would be great to have the PAL League is wonderful. And, you know, when I was growing up, police officers were your friends. too oftentimes kids don't view that, and I don't know why. I don't know if it's because of the neighborhood they're living in or, you know, what they've heard on the street. But the more that they see involvement from community leaders, whether it's police officers or city or county commissioners, the more I think we'll get together. And the kids, they just want hope, and they want somebody to believe in them. And the more we believed in those kids, our kids didn't get in trouble. You know, we did records request. In a mile and a half radius of the club, over an 18-month period, there were like 800 or something juvenile arrests. Not one of those involved a Boys and Girls Club kid. And it's not just Boys and Girls Club, but the other nonprofits that are doing wonderful work. If there was more support and collaboration, that's what keeps the kids out of trouble. Right. They will gravitate towards something, and you want them to gravitate towards something positive. If something positive is not there with positive mentors and positive influences, then they're going to go the other direction, and then that's when they're going to pick up the gun or resort to violence.
Okay, so it's sort of that nature abhors a vacuum kind of thing, and unless you have programs like that and interventions in really, really early, like you said, Ed Clark, you know, the law of the streets takes over, and that's what the kids are going to gravitate toward.
Right.
And I mean, I'm sorry, principals told us they were already seeing gang activity in third graders.
Exactly.
Third graders. So that's why, you know, people talk about high school graduation. High school graduation starts in kindergarten. You know, it doesn't start when the kid enters high school and then suddenly, oh, we have to get involved in this child's life. It takes a community at a very young age.
And how do you even find these kids? I mean, before it's time for, like, the elementary school or the middle school intervention. You know, a lot of these kids are under the radar.
Well, I think that's where the community comes in with schools. You know, schools see these children. I was amazed when I was with Guardian Ad Litem or when I was at the public defender's office going to court and seeing a child hadn't been in school for 60 days. 60 days? Excuse me, where were we on day, you know, 3, day 4, day 5? Mm-hmm. I mean, I really do think it's more of a community issue whether you live in the north side or the south side. It's a community issue.
Okay. Wanted to remind folks that you're listening to Perspectives in case you are just joining us. And Roy, we know you're waiting there on line one. We'll get to your question right after the break that is upcoming. We've got Ed Clark with the Institute of Public Health at Florida A&M University, Pastor Rudy Ferguson, a New Birth Tabernacle of Praise on Harlem Street, Teresa Fleury, who we just heard from, former president CEO of Boys and Girls Club of the Big Band, and Tallahassee Police Chief Michael DeLeo. And your calls, too, 414-1234 on Perspectives. Back on Perspectives, talking about the incidents of gun violence in Tallahassee, which, as we just heard from Ed Clark before the break, is on a par with Miami-Dade County. That is terrifying. That really is. Let's go to the phones here. Roy's been patiently awaiting on line one. Hi, Roy. Thanks for hanging on. Welcome to Perspectives.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you taking my call. I have an inquiry, and of course, everybody's got an opinion, and obviously, it's going to take a community involvement and support from the entire community, and I think a number of folks, most folks, agree to that. But I have recently, as I listened to local radio, heard an issue come up regarding the Tallahassee Police Department with regards to funding, and as I listened to it, you know, I was just not aware of it, and I'm asking for the chief to comment on, you know, the issue of funding, and I'm curious as to whether or not during your interview with the city manager, whether funding was discussed, because from what this little talk show program had, the idea and the concept of the days gone past where you have officers you know, that spend a career in neighborhoods and getting to know families and people, and that takes manpower. And has he come to, have you come to any conclusion, or are you still in the process? I know you're so new here, but have you come to the conclusion of maybe not specifically the total funding that's needed for additional officers, but is this something you've discussed with city officials, and do you see any support there? And if so, what are you seeing in terms of what ultimately may be needed to get a proper handle on this thing?
Okay, Chief DeLeo, I know the city's going through the whole budgetary process right now. They had a workshop just the other day. So how's funding for TPD right
now?
So
far, it's been pretty good. The principles Roy's talking about really is community policing, which is, you know, although we kind of repackage, rename things every year, the fact is basically policing is about relationships, getting to know people, developing relationships, talking with people, more importantly, listening and building trust. Obviously, having, you know, people with enough time to spend more time, whether it's a victim or a community member they see to talk with, it is a good thing and helps establish those relationships. That's been a philosophy at this agency for a long time, well before I got here, and we're continuing that. One of the things that we've done the last few months is to create another dedicated squad of officers whose job is to just work on the south side of the city to help develop those relationships and work on long-term quality of life issues instead of going call to call. I've met with all the commissioners, obviously, over the last few months, and the city manager. They're receptive to that. They know the importance of it. We were able to create that other squad with the existing personnel and just shuffling some assignments around. Obviously, right now on the forefront of everyone's minds is the violent crime, and the commission has so far in the process approved an additional squad of officers, a sergeant and five officers, whose job is going to be specifically looking at data-driven, based on crime analysis, targeting where robberies are occurring or shootings are occurring, and focusing on violent crime response. So it'll be a more immediate response as far as what's the information telling us right now, what's the current issue. And so we're trying to balance out those different needs. And like every other community right now in Florida and throughout the country, obviously the last few years with the depression and the tax base and everything else, funding's been a challenge for every department, not just the police department. You look at Parks and Rec and Public Works, and there's a lot of projects throughout not only our city community but statewide that need to be done, and the commission's got a difficult job balancing those out. But they've been very receptive, very supportive, and approving this additional group of people so far. And then obviously this is a first step, and as we continue to grow, and we'll you know, try to build and build appropriately and responsibly with our resources first.
Okay, and Pastor Ferguson, since at the outset you had mentioned that is a prime topic of concern among some folks, is just this distrust of law enforcement. Does it help to have, you know, the old-fashioned cop out walking the beat, and you know Officer Jim, you know, he's been your pal since you were a little tiny kid, and you may develop a different attitude towards police officers?
Well, I would say that it's not the whole entire community who have distrust with the police department. Let's be pragmatic. It's only criminals who's got a problem with police department. And so they have a tendency to push back out to those younger minds who have not yet developed a sense of distrust with law enforcement. So they will hear the older people say certain negative things about law enforcement. It's only in some instances because they have had a run-in with the law, because they may have broken the law. And so, therefore, their situation with law enforcement is timid. But I would say that young people, their young minds, if we as a community, the church, residents who are law-abiding citizens can say, hey, listen, let's not allow these negative influences to shape our young minds. And start doing programs and start doing real tangible things that they can walk away with, something that will help them in the future. If we don't do anything or say anything or have meetings like that, like I had at the church, then this problem, this situation will immediately continue to grow. And before you know it, you have a situation where young people who initially had no problem with law enforcement now has a problem with law enforcement based on what they heard somebody else say. So the goal was to eliminate the nonsense, as I would say at church, dispense with the nonsense, and let's simply go with what we need to teach our young people so that they can understand what it is to be law-abiding citizens and have a good rapport with law enforcement. Lastly, because if someone breaks into our home, The first person we are, the first number we're dialing is 9, and the following two is 1-1. And so we need to let them know that law enforcement is there to protect and serve the community. And also, we need to also observe the police officers to make sure that we go hand in hand together, protecting our community and serving our community.
Of course, not every interaction that young people have, a negative interaction with law enforcement, comes as a result of what you described, you know, burglaries or even gun violence. But sometimes it's just kind of quirking off in school, and suddenly the kid finds him or herself having to deal with law enforcement from a very early age. Mm-hmm. Back during the break, you folks were kicking around the concept of zero tolerance.
Right.
And how sometimes that in our schools can cause kids to, instead of going to the principal's office, you know, be headed for court. So, Ed Clark, what influence does that have?
Well, to the pastor's point, just to address some of the issues that he brought up, I don't think it's always the case that it's the criminals that have a mistrust of the police. And I don't want this to digress into a discussion about the police. I think the police here do a wonderful job, and we're blessed to have them. But that said, you know, there's a history of mistrust between certain populations and the police. And with the issue of zero tolerance in school, again, it renders some people, well, it ties the hands of some folks, and it ushers our kids directly into the criminal justice system, which is literally a bottomless pit for them. And once they're involved in that tangled web, is very difficult to get out. We have to come to terms with bringing discipline back to the schools and not allowing the schools to default to law enforcement to handle things that should be handled at the school level. And with that said, I think that some of the early those early interactions with police from schools, from children in schools, translates to what happens when they interact with police on the streets. And, you know, they have a mistrust, and they feel like it's them against us. And that's something that we can address at the school level, also at the community level. I think parents have to be more proactive about telling their kids how to interact with police and how to be cordial and how to, you know, be respectful and to not make a bad situation worse, or not to make a normal situation become a bad situation. So, again, the zero tolerance is something that we can address as a community at the school level. And again, I think that would have a greater impact on the way that our young people perceive our police force.
Gun violence in the capital city area and the community response, 414-1234, our number here on Perspectives, 800-926-8809. Barbara, patiently awaiting on line two. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. Good morning. I'm so glad to hear you talking about the influence on young minds. Last week, I went to my favorite grocery store, and there were two young boys, maybe 8 and 12 years old, in front of the magazine rack. They were very excitedly looking through a number of magazines. Mother thought it was pornography, and in a way it was. I went back to see what they were looking at. On the rack, there were 9 magazines glamorizing guns. Let me read you the titles of these magazines, because I was so appalled I made a note of them. Recoil, Combat Tactics, Guns and Ammo, Pocket Pistols, Concealed Carry Handguns, and Concealed Carry Handguns Special Edition, Shooting Illustrated, and another one called Guns, and one called Guns and Gardens. I'm appalled that Publix is displaying all of these magazines. Anyway, I just had to put that in. Thank you.
I appreciate it, Barbara. How much does that play into it, though? We've always, I guess, since the founding of the Republic, have had this, you know, usually a man, but, you know, a person and their long rifle against the universe, or at least the frontier. And that's just part of America. Is this the modern expression? What do you think, Teresa?
Have you seen some of these video games? And I'm sure, you know, I'm probably going to get, you know, in trouble when I leave here. But, you know, at the club, I know we wouldn't let them play any violent games. I'm sorry, but when young minds, you know, play games where all they do is shoot each other. I walked in one time and a young man said, "Miss Teresa, it's okay, we're just shooting each other." I was like, "Excuse me? Like, that's okay?" I think it has a great impact if that is what is glamorized. Again, I think it goes back to education and the churches and the community and really giving these kids something other than guns to look up to.
Mm-hmm.
you know, educated people. You know, what's wrong with being educated and getting that degree and going to school instead of the guns being glamorized?
Mm-hmm. And yet, how do you also balance, and you said something about this, Ed Clark, that really stuck in my mind, the fact that so many of these kids live in dangerous neighborhoods, and on one hand, you hear from folks, particularly those who are, you know, pushing open carry and all that kind of thing, you know, an expression of Second Amendment rights because it's a dangerous world out there. Well, yeah, but you live in a neighborhood where crime very seldom happens. Meanwhile, you have young people who live in neighborhoods where there is a lot more crime, and aren't they kind of exercising their Second Amendment rights too?
Well, the fact of the matter is that few adolescents actually own guns. But most of them have access to guns very readily. And that's where we kind of get ourselves into a slippery slope type of situation where we, to defend individual rights, has an adverse effect on community safety. So these kids, are they exercising their Second Amendment right? Some would argue that. But in Florida, you have to be 21 to own a handgun. So any time that a young person has a handgun, they're operating outside of the law. Unfortunately, they're in a community, some of them, not all, where they feel the need to protect themselves or defend themselves from the culture of violence that's endemic to our country, I would argue. You know, these magazines that we see on racks, you know, you could turn on the news daily and see reports about gun violence. You have this debate about the Second Amendment and whether or not it protects a state's right to have a militia, our individual's right to have a firearm. And so safety, I think public safety is lost in the argument somewhere. But unfortunately, guns are readily available in all of our communities. And that said, those guns were at one point bought as legal weapons. They didn't enter the public realm as illegal guns. They were all purchased at the point of purchase legally, and they found themselves in our communities, and our kids can gain access to them. So whether or not they're exercising their Second Amendment right, I would argue that they're not in those communities. But that's where this has to be looked at from a community perspective, and perhaps people may have to not give up the Second Amendment right, but compromise a bit for public safety.
Well, Chief DeLeo, talking to a former TPDer of my long acquaintance, the other day he was saying it is now, sad to say, part of the training of contemporary law enforcement officers in all agencies that the presumption is that the citizen is armed. You have to approach it that way. Is that true?
I don't know about the presumption that every citizen is armed, but the fact is obviously officer safety is part of their training throughout from the academy on throughout their entire career. And I just want to be careful that we make a very clear distinction. You know, for the most part today, we're talking about gun crimes. We're not talking about legal gun ownership. We're not talking about responsible right. legal gun ownership. And that's a very easy way to kind of lose track of the focus on, you know, we're not talking about, you know, men and women who legally own a gun, they're being responsible for or anything else under law. We're talking about people who are using weapons to prey on the rest of our community.
Sure.
And that's mm-hmm. what I think we really need to be focused on, because right. otherwise we can lose track very quickly. I will say that part of that responsible gun ownership, like you know, Ed Clark was saying, is, you know, secure your weapon, put it away, don't leave it in your car, don't leave it in your unlocked car, because we do have a lot of firearms that get stolen, and then that's how we see the spread and the availability. But there's a big distinction between legal gun ownership and the gun crimes that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. As far as the training for officers, obviously officer safety is a huge issue. I think unfortunately, when you see, you know, some of the crime stats that, you know, Ed already referred to and we've talked about, you know, that have been going on, and you see the rate of violent crime here, you know, when the officers get sent to a violent call, obviously the assumption is there's already been an act of violence. Safety is paramount and everything else. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, that's a strong consideration. I mean, you know, unfortunately, it is a dangerous profession. There is a balance. But the fact is those safety considerations are always balanced out by the person's constitutional rights. And that's something that our officers are trained on and every year. They get legal training, legal updates, and there's a balancing act there that has to apply.
Regardless of what anyone says, it's tough being a cop today.
I think it's been a tough being a cop for since the profession it first existed. You're talking about balancing out, you know, needs of communities and people's perspectives and the rules of, why are you stopping me? Why aren't you stopping that car? And, you know, there's always that, you know, is there a double standard or not and everything else. So, you know, it's a tough profession. But the fact is, I think, when done right, it's an honorable, noble profession with a lot of opportunities to do good.
Back to the phones we go in perspectives. Talbot is on line three. Hi, Talbot. I think Talbot's still there, I hope.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Can y'all hear me?
Yes, sir. Go right ahead.
Okay, thank you. Sorry, lost signal there. I was going to say, I have a little background kind of working with some at-risk youth. I ran a community service and program for middle school students in Arkansas, mostly kids whose parents or older brothers had been involved in crimes. We dealt with a lot of kids who kind of in that, you know, that critical position at a young age where places such as the Boys and Girls Club make a huge difference. And kind of one of the things I wanted to talk about or just ask y'all's opinion on, and it seems like it's the elephant in the room that no one's discussing, is the breakdown of the family in a lot of these communities where gun violence is high. And based upon my own personal experience working with these kids, we just saw it seemed like, you know, those parents, a lot of them, even with our kids, their parents maybe supported them doing this program if the child wanted to, but a lot of the parents just weren't very involved. And, you know, what are y'all doing to, through church or community, to involve these parents as well, other than, you know, just the community aspect of it and outsiders, if you will, getting involved?
Great point, Talbot, and we'll go around the table and tackle that one here on the other side of the break that's rapidly upcoming here on Perspectives. Gun violence in and around the capital city is what we're talking about here this morning on Perspectives, and the number to call with your input is 414-1234. If it's long distance from you to us, it's 800-926-8809, or you can always pop us an email at perspectives@wfsu.org. We'll be right back. Back on Perspectives, gun violence in and around the Tallahassee area, which has been so much in the news of late. And we just heard from Talbot, who was giving us a call and remarking on the impact of family on this entire issue when it comes to particularly kids and guns. And let's Teresa Fleury, of Fleury and Atkins, by the way, as well as former president of CEO of the Boys and Girls Club, the Big Band. In your dealings with kids, the family unit, how important is that, really?
You know, it's extremely important. You know, at the Boys and Girls Club, I think it was about 70% of our kids came from single-parent homes. And so the Boys and Girls Club or, you know, other nonprofits that the kids may become involved with become the family because it does take a village. You know, when I was growing up, if I was at my friend's house, their parents would discipline me just as my own parents would. And I think, you know, especially when you're a single parent and you're working two or three jobs, you know, to make ends meet, you need that extra help from churches or other people in the community. And I think that, unfortunately, people do a lot of talking, but when it comes to really helping, that's what we need. We need people on the ground floor, so to speak, volunteering at these agencies, volunteering at school, helping these children become a big brother, become a big sister, and really helping that family unit, because the family unit has definitely changed from when, you know, we were growing up.
Okay. Pastor Rudy Ferguson, the church has always been paramount in the community. How can you reassert, I guess, that influence, particularly for younger folks who may not be listening so much to Pastor Rudy Ferguson? They're listening more to Reverend Rick Ross.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what it comes down to is that pastors, we have to meet people where they are. That's the first and foremost. We have to leave the pulpit and we have to hit the pavement. And I believe that once we show the community and those around that we're not just there for pastors' anniversaries, church anniversaries, and revivals, but that we're actually there to empower people to enact on what the scriptures have already said for them to do, and that is to be successful, and that is to be positive. That's the things that we have to do. And I think that what I decided to do was take my church to that dimension. And we have already enacted and got approved at my church in on Harlem Street, Alabama Street, the Griffin Heights neighborhood, is to, for the very first time, have a GED program. We have a lot of young people and adults who don't have their GED or high school diploma. So what we're going to do is meet them where they are. And they are about 50 feet away. A lot of them are 50 feet away from the church. So we're going to transpose the church and change it into a classroom. Not only that, we have a program that we've had in place for a while called the United Parents Positive Action Coalition, which for short we call UPAC. And so what we're trying to do is reach out to parents, young parents in particular, 16, 17, 18 years old, who don't know how to be parents because they're babies themselves. And so we're reaching out to do different things like that, taking a non-traditional and an unconventional approach to dealing with a lot of different things to show them something tangible. Lastly, I would say it's very hard to take some money out of a young person's hand who's been selling dope or whatever the situation may be, and give them an empty promise. You have to give them something now that's tangible that can replace the negative. You have to turn that negative energy into positive energy by giving them something that can be immediate impact and a positive resolution in their life right now.
Okay, and Chief DeLeo, even though the prime role of law enforcement is not to promote family values of all, you still have some programs at the Tallahassee Police Department that are supportive of this whole thing, too.
Yeah, no, we do. We do have a lot of programs that work with both, you know, juveniles and adults. Teresa mentioned earlier our TPAL program, Tallahassee, Police Athletic League. We're in a summer basketball program. That's a program that we're working and trying to expand into other sports and activities for next summer. We have our cadet program for people that may be interested in a career in law enforcement or learning about law enforcement someday, where they can come and work with the officers and ride with officers. We have a leadership program called TAC Students that actually is being modeled right now by the IACP, and on their website is a model program nationwide for helping develop leadership skills and qualities in high school students. We have our Defiant program for drug resistance. And, you know, so we do have a lot of programs that we try to reach out and provide positive interactions and give skills and knowledge for the future and help to build on.
Okay. Ed Clark, your research there as far as the impact of the family on this this whole dynamic that we've been talking about there, pretty critical stuff.
Right. Well, in public health, we've come to understand that poverty is one of the underlying social determinants of health. And in this case, gun violence is also an indicator of health. Our children are basically the litmus test of how well we're doing as a country. And as it stands now, we're not doing very well because our kids are being killed by this gun violence. But to Teresa's point, when you have parents who are trying to make the ends meet and by no fault of their own or don't have the time afterwards to know what the kids are doing or where the kids are, the resources to enter them into programs, you know, that leaves these kids really to have to raise themselves and make difficult choices on their own. So, again, with my research, we know that addressing poverty is one of the ways that we can kind of address some of the accompanying ills that are related to it. And one of those is gun violence. And so we as a community, I think, have to commit ourselves, the business community as well as law enforcement, our nonprofits and our church leaders, to finding ways to get people involved in the economic machine of our community. And in that way, we can address some of the other issues that stem out of that.
Okay. Brian's giving us a call here on line four. Welcome to Perspectives, Brian.
Good morning. How are you, Tom?
Hey, real fine. Thanks, Brian. Thanks for calling.
Well, thanks for having this panel. Thank you, panelists, for being there. I have to say I'm calling because I definitely agree with what the aspect that Teresa has added to this, that it's a community problem. And let me give you a couple of instances. I live in Northeast Tallahassee in the Summerbrook subdivision, and a month or two ago, my son's friend had his truck shot up and riddled with bullets in the Childs High School parking lot. This morning, I woke up to have a Tallahassee Utilities Department truck in front of my house. And I went out. I happen to have a street light in front of the house. I went out and I was speaking with the gentleman, and he showed me the light. And it had been riddled with bullets. The interesting thing is it was riddled with bullets, and they were obviously of different caliber because the bullet holes were of different sizes. I agree with Pastor Ferguson. He mentioned that, you know, this isn't just a poverty issue, but it's an availability issue. And I just hope that we all start to think about the fact that when guns are so readily available, you know, they're going to be used. And, you know, I just gave you two instances of what I hope was just, you know, vandalism. But, you know, when guns are around and they're readily available, they're, you know, there are suicides that happen that we don't often include in the crime statistics, but they should be included, shouldn't they? I mean, it's still the use of a gun, you know, for a violent act, whether it's killing yourself or somebody else. You know, there are practical, common sense things that could be done, and it's just so frustrating to me. But I do hope to be more involved with the movement towards, you know, at least let's expand the use of background checks. And I'd really like to know the chief's position on that. There's often the 100% agreement that we don't want guns in the hands of felons and we don't want guns in the hands of the mentally ill. But there's no practical way of removing those guns or keeping them from them unless we do background checks or expand the use of background checks. So I know we go to a certain degree every year with this, but then it stops. And Chief, I was wondering, you know, if you have a position on the expansion of background checks, are you a supporter, or do you have other common sense changes we can make to reduce this problem?
Gee, wish we had a lawmaker here. But Chief DeLeo, just from when it comes time to try to, let's say, track down a firearm that was used in the commission of a crime, sometimes that in itself is a real challenge, as I understand it.
Trying to track down a firearm after the fact is extremely challenging because there's no requirement tracking, you know, a centralized database from, you know, transfer of gun ownership to another person. Not everybody reports crimes when they're victims of crimes, right? Underreporting of crimes, an issue nationwide has been for all levels of crime, whether it's property crime, person crimes, everything else. So there may be guns that are stolen that, you know, the police are never aware of. There's laws that restrict the databases of weapons and things like that. And again, it's that balancing act between legal gun ownership and privacy rights versus public safety. And you know, I understand what our caller is saying about some common sense approaches, but you know, let's be frank, the common sense and law don't always mesh, and there's a balancing act, and we've got a strong history. You know, the country is based on individual rights and protection from an overbearing government, and you know, so you have people that, you know, cling to that, and you had other people who, you know, want, you know, more government, and those are other issues aside. And that's why the focus here is on the gun violence and violent crime, and what can we do to address that? I don't think necessarily that, you know, there's obviously challenges of background checks and mental health issues when you've got laws protecting people's medical health, you know, history and things like that. But maybe it's not so much the background checks. Maybe we need to better fund and better support mental health professionals and public availability programs for people who need access to mental health cases. So you know, that's a whole nother discussion, but it's not just running somebody through a system. It's really identifying where we need to place resources, where they're most effective long term, and not just saying we did something to do something.
Okay, Ed Clark, you wanted to jump in there.
Yeah, I wanted to jump in because I don't want the perception to be made that people who have mental illness are violent. Generally speaking, the mentally ill are not people who commit gun crimes. I know here lately that, you know, we've had some mass shootings in different areas and people attribute that to mental illness, but that's not usually the case. The mentally ill are not usually violent. But to the caller's point, suicide is another issue that that stems from guns. And firearms are the number one choice of suicide mechanism by people who decide to do that, particularly young men between the ages of 10 and 25. That said, between the ages of 10 and 25, African-American males are victims of homicide by guns more than any other group in the country, too. So the tool of choice of the gun is a problem, and there ought to be some common sense things that we can do to reduce the deadly nature of the weapons. And to that end, I mean, if we could have legislation to reduce magazine capacities and things of that nature, the types of guns that are available, we may be able to address that. But whether or not the political will exists to do that is another issue.
Before we go back to the streets, something on a related line there, Chief, I believe you have a gun. TBD has a gun buyback that's coming up pretty soon too, right?
Yes. In mid-August, August 15th and 16th, we're doing two different dates, gun buyback program to help, you know, hopefully alleviate some of again, responsible gun ownership of people who don't want the guns anymore, don't want firearms anymore, and that we're working with a partnership with Noble and some other groups to help try to get some of the excess weapons, you know, out of homes and off streets for people that don't want them anymore.
Yeah. Let me ask you, Teresa Flory, do you think those work? That helps any to get the excess firepower?
I'm sure it does. I mean, I know it doesn't hurt, but you know, what we had tried to do at the club was give them a reason not to want to go to the gun. You know, I mean, nothing was more sad than having someone as young as first or second grade come into the club and you could see that they believe their entire life's path is already written for them. There was like no hope that they could ever do better. By giving them support and encouragement and letting them know we believed in them, school became more important. You saw the attitude and behavioral change almost like appear before your eyes. If we start concentrating on giving our young people better education and more opportunities, right, they're not going to want to turn to those guns. It's like growing up, you know, I didn't want to do something that could impinge me going to law school. Mm-hmm. You know, if you give them something that, yes, you can do this. You may have to work harder than mm-hmm. somebody else, but you can do this. Maybe that's the approach that we need to take and start supporting them and positive behavior and not just what other kinds of laws can we pass.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah, because when the only tool you have to address a problem is a law, then everything starts looking like a crime.
Yes.
For some reason. Let's get a few more calls in if we possibly can here. Let's go to Bill on line one if we can, folks. Hi, Bill. Welcome to Perspectives.
Thank you. I just want to make a couple of brief points. One is someone made a statement about only criminals had problems with the police. I mean, that's a horrible statement in the light of the history of the oppression of the civil rights and human rights of people in this country by police officers. And I'm not just talking about just black people. I mean, this is the incidence of police abuse is growing in this country. The other thing is the organizations in the black community, like the NAACP and the Urban League and the churches, are missing in action and have been missing in action for decades, socially and politically. And political action, it's like we are so busy trying to get ready to go to heaven is we are not prepared to organize politically and socially to change our environment.
Okay, some good points there. Let's go in turn here. Chief DeLeo, the perception that, again, the law enforcement has in many instances of this nation's history been used as a kind of tool of oppression or to protect the status quo or whatever else. It seems in recent years, though, there has been an intense effort on the part of law enforcement to, again, professional accreditation, some kind of oversight, you know, within the community, more diversity on the force, those kinds of things. Is that to address some of the things that he was talking about?
No, I think so. There's a strong, you know, sense of, you know, we are part of the community. I mean, it's say you go back to Sir Robert Peel, kind of the father of modern policing, and the police are the community are the police. It goes back to what I said kind of when we started. It's about relationships, working together, listening, and part of that's being reflective and being open and being transparent and be willing to sit and listen to criticism and feedback like we did with the town hall meeting. And, you know, the pastor invited me over and, you know, go and you listen and you try to learn from it and what you can do better. I will say that the vast majority of officers and that I've met throughout my career over the last 20 years want to do the right thing, try to do the right thing. Are there bad apples in our profession? Yeah, absolutely. There are in every profession. I'm not going to color it or anything else. Mm-hmm. And the test comes in is when we identify that person that's not living up to the standard or living up to the expectation is make sure we deal with it and address it appropriately. Yeah. So that the way they don't continue to have that impact on the community and on the profession. And it's not about hiding things. It's about being open and honest about it.
Oh, okay. Pat and Pastor Rudy there, his remark there about the church is kind of being missing in action on this thing. I mean, you opened your church for a community forum, mm-hmm. several kinds of meetings
yes.
here. So,
well, the main thing I think that all churches, irregardless of denomination, one thing we ought to be able to do is speak life. and that is to celebrate life more than we just talk about going to heaven, like the caller said, in particular, preparing to go to heaven. But I believe there's a work that's involved in going to heaven, and I believe the work begins right here at the church. It begins with the leaders, the clergy. It begins with the members. It begins there, and then it matriculates out into the community if we're reaching out to work with our young people, to work with the families, and to show them that, you know, it's more than just coming to church, but it's more as working as a church in the community.
Okay, let's get back. Let's see, who do we have here? George has been hanging there on line five for seemingly forever. Hey, George, welcome to Perspectives.
Hey, Tom. A couple of things I noticed. One thing is, if you all remember, last year President Obama stressed, in fact, wanted to pass laws for background checks and such.
George, hold that thought right there. I think we're going to have another follow-up program here on Perspectives to continue this discussion here as the time draws nigh for us to bail. By the way, Political Perspectives coming up next week. We'd like to thank our panel, Pastor Rudy Ferguson, Teresa Fleury, Tallahassee Police Chief Michael DeLeo, Ed Clark over at FAMU, and, of course, the input from all of our listeners right here on Perspectives. Political Perspectives again with the mayor's race next Tuesday right here on Perspectives.
Audio copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcast. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.